You know that voice, don't you? It's instantly recognizable, timeless, synonymous with cool, with class, with a certain defiant elegance.
Absolutely. You hear it, and maybe My Way or New York, New York just pops into your head immediately.
Right. But behind that legendary sound, behind all the headlines and the Rat Pack stories, there's a story that's far richer, more complex, and often pretty surprising than most people realize.
Way more complex.
Welcome, deep divers. Today we're taking a truly exhaustive deep dive into a colossal titan of the 20th century, Frank Sinatra.
And we've really gathered an incredible stack of material for you. I mean, everything from official birth records, detailed career
To
analyses.
intensely personal anecdotes, even declassified FBI files. It's quite a collection.
It really is.
Our mission for you, our curious listener, is to move beyond the polished legend, the tabloid stuff.
Yeah, get past the easy image.
We're going to uncover the pivotal, sometimes traumatic moments, the surprising, sometimes contradictory influences.
And just the sheer unyielding grit that forged Old Blue Eyes into this unparalleled cultural force.
He really did seem to embody that self-made American dream, didn't he? But in all its complicated, dazzling, and sometimes, well, dark glory.
Exactly. You might know him mostly for the timeless songs, the charisma on stage, maybe the powerful movie roles.
Sure, the obvious stuff.
But what becomes so clear digging through these sources is how his challenging, sometimes brutal beginnings profoundly shaped his, well, insatiable ambition, that relentless drive.
We're going to meticulously unpack the dramatic, sometimes almost catastrophic turns in his career.
We'll delve into his deep, often kind of unacknowledged commitment to civil rights.
Which is fascinating in itself, and we have to squarely face the persistent controversies too, the ones that seem to follow him like a shadow, right?
Oh, yeah, for decades. What's truly remarkable, if you connect the dots, is how his biggest personal struggles and his most amazing triumphs, they weren't just happening alongside his art.
No, they were the fuel.
They became the raw material. They directly fueled his artistic output, giving his music that emotional depth, that authenticity, that vulnerability that just resonated so deeply with millions for generations.
Well, buckle up. We're about to explore the real man behind the voice.
It's a journey that's going to reveal intense contradictions, that vulnerability mixed with incredible toughness.
And that unwavering, almost obsessive drive that kept him right at the absolute top of his game for decades.
We're peeling back the layers on Francis Albert Sinatra.
Okay, let's unpack this right from the very beginning, because
Okay.
Frank Sinatra's entry into the world, it was anything but gentle.
No kidding.
Right.
Francis Albert Sinatra, born December 12, 1915, a tenement building, 415 Monroe Street in Hoboken, New Jersey.
There's a plaque there now, isn't there?
Yep. But yeah, not a gentle start at all. He weighed a remarkable 13.5 pounds.
13 and a half. Wow.
Huge. And the delivery required forceps.
Oof. And that procedure, it left lifelong scarring, right? On his face, neck.
Left cheek, neck, left ear. And not just that, the trauma perforated his eardrum.
A condition he had his whole life.
His entire life. And it had big implications later on, especially, with the military service thing.
Right. And can you imagine the start? He was apparently resuscitated by his grandmother.
Yeah. Under cold running water, he was seemingly stillborn, gasping for his first breath.
That's just incredible. So traumatic that his baptism was delayed for a month.
April 2, 1916. It was a remarkably difficult, almost violent entry into the world, especially for someone who became one of the most visible, charismatic figures ever.
It really puts things in perspective from the start.
That early trauma and then, later childhood operations on his mastoid bone, more scars, severe cystic acne as a teenager. It's not just biographical detail.
No, it's a lens, isn't it, to see his later drive.
Absolutely. If you think psychologically, maybe that early battle against physical vulnerability just instilled this relentless need to control things, his environment, his image, his destiny.
Like he had to dominate stages, boardrooms, everything.
It seems like it. Almost like unconsciously overcompensating for that initial helplessness his whole life, projecting invulnerability, that tough persona.
Masking the scars, physical and maybe emotional too.
It really makes you wonder, doesn't it? How much did those hidden physical struggles, the scars he tried to hide, the hearing issue he managed, how much did that fuel his insatiable ambition, his perfectionism?
It definitely points to someone who felt he had something profound to prove, maybe mostly to himself.
Yeah, I think so.
So, with such a dramatic start, maybe it's no surprise his parents were larger than life too, Dolly and Marty. Quite the characters, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. His mother, Natalina Dolly Garaventa, an Italian immigrant, described as energetic, incredibly driven, a total force of nature.
Big in local Democratic politics, midwife, interpreter.
Ward leader, but not always on the right side of the law. She ran an illegal abortion service, got arrested multiple times, convicted twice.
Hatpin Dolly, they called her.
That's the infamous nickname. Then his father, Antonino Martino, Marty Sinatra. Illiterate, a former bantamweight boxer.
Yeah. But became a captain in the Hoboken Fire Department. That's grit.
Yeah, and despite being illiterate himself, he really pushed Frank towards education. Wanted him to be a civil engineer, go to Stevens Institute.
Quite the dynamic duo. Ambition, pragmatism, a little bit of the underworld, maybe.
Definitely set the stage for Frank's own complex personality.
Right. And Nancy Sinatra, Frank's daughter, she points to Dolly's steel will as absolutely crucial to his character.
She thought it helped him counter Dolly's sometimes belittling attitude about his music career. And, maybe strangely, kept him competitive at the top of his game.
Barbara Sinatra, his fourth wife, even said Dolly knocked him around a lot as a kid. Intense upbringing.
Physically and emotionally intense, it sounds like. That combative relationship with his strong-willed mother, plus his dad pushing education and hard work.
And the environment of their tavern during Prohibition, right?
Right.
Where Frank sang for change.
Exactly. All that shaped him. It created this really complex person. Vulnerable to criticism, but incredibly tough. Able to take hits and keep coming back.
You can see how Dolly's influence especially might have impacted his grit, his determination, maybe even his later dealings with powerful people.
Yeah, he learned how to navigate power and influence really young.
So with these strong parents, it makes sense why, despite his dad wanting him to be an engineer, Frank was drawn to something else entirely. Music.
Rhythm and melody, yeah. He got a ukulele for his 15th birthday, and that was it. Performance bug bit him hard, started arranging bands for school dances.
Idolized the crooners of the day. Bing Crosby, obviously.
Bing, Gene Austin, Rudy Vallée, Russ Colombo, Bob Eberly. He soaked it all up.
Oh.
But formal education, definitely not his path.
Expelled from high school after 47 days for general rowdiness. Class.
Total Frank move, even then. Rebellious streak. Tried Drake Business School. Left after 11 months. Just couldn't fit the conventional mold.
The classroom wasn't his stage. His education came from, well, hard knocks and smoky clubs.
This period really shows his raw, natural talent and that independent streak. It's amazing he never learned to read music but learned by ear.
Especially back then, with so many formally trained musicians.
Right. And his early jobs, delivery boy for the Jersey Observer, riveter at the shipyard, show that working class background.
Grounded. But he kept chasing the music, didn't he? Singing for free on local radio, WAT.
Wherever he could find an audience, just honing his craft. And what's really revealing is that dollar-an-hour elocution lesson.
With John Quinlan, supposed to improve his speech.
But instead, Quinlan spots his impressive vocal range, his potential. One of the first professionals to really hear it.
The precursor to The Voice.
Exactly. It shows that even raw talent needs that bit of recognition, that refinement. To really take off. Quinlan's insight was pivotal.
And his mother, Dolly, she was key again for his first big break, wasn't she? 1935.
Absolutely instrumental. She somehow talked this local group, the Three Flashes, into letting Frank join.
And the reason they agree, it's almost comical.
He owned a car.
Yeah.
A Chrysler. Huge asset back in the Depression for a group that needed to travel.
So they became the Hoboken Four, won Major Bowes Amateur Hour national radio show.
Yeah. Earned $12.50 each. Got a 6-month contract for stage and radio work. A taste of success.
But it came with a downside. Jealousy from the other guys.
Intense jealousy. They were physically bigger, and Frank was getting all the attention. Sources even mentioned brawls, them beating him up backstage.
Wow. Harsh introduction to show business.
Brutal. But it clearly shows his early magnetic charisma. He stood out, even when outmatched physically. Became the lead singer fast, got the girls' attention.
Which just fueled the jealousy more, I bet.
Totally. His next step was singing waiter, MC, at the Rustic Cabin in Inglewood Cliffs. $15 a week.
Peanuts, really. But he thought that was his break.
He really did. Told friends he was going to become so big that no one could ever touch him. You got to admire the confidence.
It makes you think, how did being singled out like that positively by fans, negatively by peers, shape his view of fame? The competition.
Probably reinforced that independent streak. Made him feel like he had to fight for every single win. It was around then he made his first solo recording, Our Love.
Arranged by Frank Main. A rare disc now.
Yeah, Maine kept it for decades, an early piece of history.
So from these small gigs, his ambition was already laser focused on bigger stages, which led him to two legends.
Harry James first, June 1939, signed him for $75 a week. A step up.
But the records didn't sell well. From the bottom of my heart, all or nothing at all.
Weak sales. Sinatra got frustrated fast. He wanted solo stardom, like yesterday.
So he made the move, James let him go, and he joined Tommy Dorsey's band in November 39, $125 a week.
A whole new league. Dorsey's band was huge. And Dorsey himself, his trombone playing?
Huge influence, right? Breath control, phrasing.
Major influence, even a father figure. Sinatra copied his mannerisms, his perfectionism, and especially those breathing techniques. Watched Dorsey's lungs when he played.
Incredible dedication, but that relationship was also fraught.
Deeply profound, but also super tense, full of control. Sinatra later said, "The only two people I've ever been afraid of are my mother and Tommy Dorsey."
That says a lot, and he was driven to beat Bing Crosby, the reigning king.
Relentlessly. But that Dorsey contract was brutal. 43% of his lifetime earnings.
43%? That's insane. No wonder he wanted out when his star started rising.
It became unbearable. The legal battle to get out was messy. Settled in August 42, but the rumors...
The mob connection, Willie Moretti supposedly threatening Dorsey at gunpoint.
Those rumors persisted. The FBI looked into a specific $40,000 payment story and dismissed it, but the official settlement was still costly. MCA paid Dorsey $35,000. Sinatra paid $25,000 he had to borrow.
Shows his fierce determination, though. Control his own destiny, no matter the cost. And those early ties would follow him.
Absolutely. Dorsey himself saw the potential early, though. Notice the excitement coming up out of the crowds for this skinny kid with big ears.
And the hit started coming with Dorsey. Polka dots and moonbeams, I'll never smile again.
That one was number one for 12 weeks. Set the stage for what came next.
Which is Pandemonium. December 1942, the Paramount Theater in New York. His solo opening.
Ignited Sinatra mania. Something totally new. Teenage girls, the Bobby Soxers.
Went absolutely wild. 1,000 fan clubs, writing song titles on their clothes, stealing bow ties.
It was madness. Jack Benny was there, said he thought the goddamn building was going to cave in for a guy he'd never heard of.
Unprecedented phenomenon. Sinatra, The Voice, Sinatratix, the Columbus Day Riot in 44.
It revealed this powerful new audience, mostly young women, whose influence was totally underestimated before then.
And his publicist, George Evans, crafted that image perfectly, didn't he?
Masterfully. The vulnerable, shy, Italian-American with a rough childhood who made good.
Carefully managed image versus the driven, sometimes volatile reality. Fascinating.
It really is. Especially juxtaposed with the wartime pressures. But controversy was brewing, too.
The 4F classification, medically unfit for service.
Right. Perforated eardrum from birth, plus a psychiatric viewpoint, citing emotional instability.
Which led to those damaging rumors about paying $40,000 to dodge the draft.
Rumors the FBI eventually dismissed after investigation, but the shadow lingered. He still did USO tours, entertained troops, met the Pope, even.
A complex mix. Nascent fame, image control, wartime scrutiny. And he signed with Columbia during this time.
Yeah, during the musician strike. Topped the Billboard and downbeat polls for male singers. He was on top of the world.
Initially, he soared at Columbia, signed solo during that musician strike in 43.
Which ironically cleared the path for vocalists like him.
His first album, The Voice of Frank Sinatra, hit number one in 46, selling 10 million records a year at his peak.
Staggering numbers for the time. He was even conducting albums like Frank Sinatra conducts the music of Alec Wilder, really exploring his passions.
Seemed unstoppable, the peak of his early solo career. But then the late 40s hit. Things started to unravel.
Pretty dramatically, yeah. Professionally and personally, it's often called the Great Fall.
By 1948, he slipped to fourth in the downbeat polls. A big drop.
Huge. His 49 album, Frankly Sentimental, got panned. Critics said it seldom comes to life, like the spark was gone.
And losing his publicist, George Evans, in 1950 must have been a blow. Evans was key to that Bobby Soxer thing.
An enormous shock, according to Jimmy Van Huysen. And what's fascinating is how his personal life started mirroring, maybe even worsening, the professional slump.
The affair with Ava Gardner, the breakup with Nancy Barbato, all very public.
Yeah, it really hurt his image. No longer the wholesome boy next door. Now he's this scandalous figure.
Then the throat hemorrhage in 1950, caused by emotional tension.
That's what his publicist said. Forced him to cancel shows. People worried he might lose his voice entirely.
Plus financial trouble, borrowing $200,000 for back taxes.
Serious trouble. By 52, Hollywood rejected him, Columbia dropped him, MCA dropped him. He played the Kauai County Fair in April.
From the Paramount to the Kauai County Fair, that's a stunning fall.
Humiliating, almost. Mitch Miller at Columbia even tried getting him to sing gimmicky songs like Mama Will Bark. Just pushed his fans further away.
Wow, rock bottom. But then, the legendary comeback. Almost miraculous.
August 1953. From here to eternity. The film that changed everything.
He was desperate for that role, Maggio, wasn't he? Lobbied hard, took a huge pay cut.
Vigorously. And it paid off. Won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. Critics called his performance simply superb.
That Oscar didn't just revive his acting career. It revitalized his whole image, showed his talent, his resilience.
Totally.
Yeah.
Though he later said he thought he won for the wrong role, believed his performance in The Man with the Golden Arm was better.
Interesting. But Eternity was the turning point, a real phoenix moment.
Absolutely seismic. It helped him reclaim his spot as the world's top recording artist, proved everyone wrong.
And almost at the same time, he signed with Capitol Records.
Yeah, March 13th, 1953. A crucial 7-year deal. And his very first session there, pivotal, with arranger Nelson Riddle.
Riddle was Nat King Cole's guy, right?
Yeah. Their first track together was I've Got the World on a String. Sinatra heard the playback and just yelled, I'm back, baby, I'm back.
Goosebumps moment.
Marked a new and brilliant phase, as biographers put it. It really shows, doesn't it, how hitting rock bottom can fuel an incredible, defiant comeback.
Absolutely. And the hits started flowing again at Capitol. Songs for Young Lovers, Young at Heart.
Young at Heart, hit number 2, Song of the Year. He was well and truly back.
Good Capitol years, especially with Nelson Riddle. That's the golden era, right? Unmatched musical innovation, artistic growth.
Totally. Albums like In the Wee Small Hours from 55.
Yeah.
That was his first 12-inch LP. Maybe his first real concept album.
Brooding, melancholy, whole mood.
Exactly. And then Songs for Swing It Lovers in 56. Just pure, sophisticated swing set a new standard.
He became a real perfectionist in the studio then, giving specific directions on arrangements.
Notoriously demanding, knew exactly the sound, the feeling he wanted, push everyone. He even inaugurated the new Capitol Records building studios with a huge 56-piece orchestra.
A statement.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And Riddle himself called Sinatra the greatest arranger in the world, praised his impeccable taste, his ability to put that overall inflection of sex into his voice.
Made every song feel intimate.
And he was pioneering the concept album, turning LPs into these novelistic works with unified themes and moods, much more than just a collection of songs.
An immersive experience.
Totally. And what's really fascinating is how his personal life, especially the split with Ava Gardner, fed directly into the music.
That brooding melancholy you mentioned.
Exactly. You hear it all over In the Wee Small Hours or Frank Sinatra Sings for Only the Lonely from 58. That album spent 120 weeks on the Billboard chart.
Wow. It wasn't just singing. It was storytelling, making his vulnerability real for listeners.
Deeply relatable. Yeah. And his recordings of classics like Night Day, The Lady is a Tramp, with that salaciousness.
Or I've Got You Under My Skin. It took 22 takes.
Yeah. Perfectionism showed his incredible range. Come Fly With Me in 58 was like a musical world tour. Got Grammy nominated too.
This era also cemented his status as Mr. Las Vegas, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Pioneer. Debuted at the Sands in 53, eventually bought a share in the place, showed his business side emerging.
And the Rat Pack. That really took off then.
Emerged in full force. Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford, Joey Bishop. But it was always Sinatra's vehicle, right?
He held unassailable command, dictated the whole show.
Biographer Rojek called it the high water mark of his hedonism and self-absorption. Lavish excess, constant partying.
But it was also an outlet for him, that gregarious side.
Absolutely. The camaraderie, the spotlight, and the relationship was symbiotic. Vegas gave him a stage for his huge personality.
And he defined Vegas glamour, drew in the crowds.
Exactly. Showed he could command any audience, concert hall, or casino floor. Made every show feel huge but intimate. He brought that celebrity cool to Vegas and changed it forever.
Okay, so he's riding high at Capitol, but he gets discontented and then does something really bold.
Incredibly bold for 1960. Forms his own record label, Reprise Records.
Revolutionary, wasn't it? Promising artists creative control, even ownership of their work eventually.
And was unheard of back then. Complete ownership, including publishing rights. He wanted a new artistic direction, too. Temporarily split with Riddle, May, Jenkins.
Brought in Neil Hefti, Don Costa, Quincy Jones.
Right. It wasn't just leaving Capitol. It was a declaration of independence.
More than just business. It was a statement about artistic freedom. And foresight.
Absolutely. Recognizing artists deserved more control. Under him, Reprise became a powerhouse, not just for his stuff, but for others too.
And he eventually sold it for a fortune, right? Around $80 million.
Yeah, he showed his incredible business sense. His first Reprise album, Ring a Ding Ding, in 61, with Quincy Jones arranging. Huge success.
Hit number four.
It shows he wasn't just the talent. He wanted to control the whole thing. Creative, business, everything.
Shaping his legacy on his own terms really earned that chairman of the board title. He set a precedent for artists wanting autonomy. Sinatra and Strings in 62, with Costa, was also acclaimed, showed his evolution.
The 60s at Reprise brought some legendary collaborations, too.
Iconic stuff. Teaming up with Count Basie for Sinatra Basie, and it might as well be swing. Just electric big band swing.
Then he explored bossa nova with Antonio Carlos Jobim. Yeah, the Francis Albert Sinatra and Antonio Carlos Jobim album in 67. Critically acclaimed, Grammy nominated, even worked with Duke Ellington on Francis A. and Edward K. in 68. Always pushing boundaries.
But maybe the song everyone remembers most from that era, My Way.
Ah, My Way. Recorded one take after Christmas 68, became this global phenomenon.
Stayed in the UK charts for a record 122 weeks. Insane.
Astonishing. But the irony, as you touched on, is that Sinatra himself apparently grew to hate singing it.
Really? Why?
He told songwriter Irvin Drake he detested it. Felt audiences saw it as this self-aggrandizing tribute to himself.
Huh. But it became this anthem of resilience, right? Especially requested at funerals.
Exactly. It transcended his personal feelings.
Yep.
Speaks volumes about the song's impact and his ability to sell a lyric, even one he disliked, with such power.
An amazing testament to his artistry. And he had other big hits then, too. The Concert Sinatra, September of My Years.
September won Album of the Year Grammy. It was a very good year. Won Best Vocal Performance. Strangers in the Night top charts. Won Record of the Year.
And the duet with Nancy, Something Stupid. Massive hit.
Yeah, a really prolific, successful period musically.
And his film career kept going strong, too. He thought The Manchurian Candidate in 62 was his best work.
His high point, yeah. Critics agreed. Praised his nuance, his dramatic range. He even directed a film, None But the Brave, in 65.
Taking control again.
Yeah.
And he did those detective movies, Tony Rome, the detective.
Cemented that gritty image, turned down Dirty Harry later because of a hand issue, and we can't forget Ocean's 11 in 60.
Quintessential Rat Pack, a cultural event. Von Ryan's Express was a big action hit, too.
Manchurian Candidate really showed his depth, though. A chilling performance. Maybe overlooked because he was Sinatra the singer.
But by 1971, after the Watertown album, which critics liked but didn't sell,
he announced his retirement, self-imposed.
Why then?
Said he was tired of entertaining people, especially when they just wanted the same old songs he was bored with.
Shows the immense pressure, right? The grind.
Totally. A conscious choice to step away. His last words on stage were from Angel Eyes. Excuse me while I disappear.
Traumatic exit. Though we know it wasn't permanent, he'd also had that run-in at Caesar's Palace in 70, where an executive pulled a gun on him.
Yeah, said he'd walk away from anything if pushed too far.
Let's dive deeper into the musical genius, the voice itself. Because that's the core, isn't it?
Ultimately, yeah. Fascinating, he never really learned to read music well.
Despite arranging bands early on, amazing year.
Incredible. A sixth Saints, for wrong notes, shifts in tempo. And he insisted on recording live with the band.
Found a special feeling there, that energy.
A spontaneity, a collaboration he felt you couldn't get with overdubs. He had a routine too, vocalizing for an hour before. Brief rehearsal with the orchestra.
Getting the balance, the emotion, just right.
Nelson Riddle described his voice as fairly rangy, with that whole spectrum.
Strident on top, smooth lyrical middle, very tender low.
Exactly. And he used it like an instrument, playing with tempo, rhythm, phrasing, made every song a little drama.
Tommy Dorsey's trombone playing was key for that breath control, right?
Foundational influence. Taught him how to sustain notes, shape melodies. Sinatra even swam daily, holding his breath underwater, rehearsing lyrics mentally.
Disciplined practice for lung power.
Barbara Sinatra mentioned his incredible ear, too. Said he'd know instantly if one guy in a 100-piece orchestra played a bum note.
Wow. That intrinsic musical understanding. It's why Chris Segal called him the greatest singer of the 20th century.
It's hard to argue. And his diction, despite the New Jersey accent in speech, became so precise when singing, every word clear.
He admired classical guys, too. Puccini, Vaughan Williams.
Yeah, broad taste.
Yeah.
And he was specific about microphones. The warm RCA Type 44 at Columbia, then the Neumann U47 at Capitol for a different sound.
Always chasing that perfect sound. Which leads to the perfectionism, legendary, almost obsessive.
Spent weeks choosing songs, poring over lyrics, always knew which arranger he wanted for each specific number.
But that drive had a downside, the volatile temperament.
Yeah, unpredictable. Could snap at anyone for the slightest misdemeanor, as one source put it. Barbara Sinatra said he was quick to anger, capable of outbursts.
Collaborators approached him with uneasiness, never knew which Frank they'd get.
Exactly. Granada suggested maybe sometimes it wasn't just about the music, but also about showing off his power over others, asserting dominance.
But there was the other side too, wasn't there?
Oh yeah, the duality. If his voice wasn't right or an arrangement wasn't working, he'd postpone the session but pay the musicians in full.
A real sign of respect for their time and talent.
Shows the generous artist alongside the demanding boss. Nancy said he was fiercely loyal to songwriters too, always credited them, showed childlike delight in a great ballad.
That mix of artistic integrity and human flaws makes him so compelling. Recorded over 1,000 songs, worked with the greats like Kahn, Stein, Van Huysen.
Sessions were usually 3 hours after his warm-up and rehearsal. Very professional when it counted.
His personal life was just as public, just as dramatic. 4 marriages.
Nancy Barbato, his childhood sweetheart. Then the incredibly turbulent marriage to Ava Gardner, Mia Farrow, and finally Barbara Marx, until his death.
The Gardner marriage was particularly explosive, right? Well-publicized fights and altercations. Tabloid gold.
Totally. He had 3 kids with Nancy Barbato, Nancy Frank Jr., Tina. Broke engagements to Lauren Bacall, Julia Prowse. Restless.
Barbara Sinatra called him a great lover and true gentleman. But the sources show lots of affairs, too.
A complex picture. He clearly pursued passion with the same intensity as his career. And his feelings for Ava Gardner, even after the divorce.
That fueled the music, the brooding ballads in the Capitol years.
Nelson Riddle certainly thought so. Suggests that deep emotional core beneath a public image, which was often chaotic privately.
And the fascination continues. That Ronan Farrow paternity question, even though Nancy dismissed it, people still talk about his personal life.
Enduring fascination. But beyond the romance, he had deep friendships. Jilly Rizzo, Van Huysen, and diverse hobbies. Classical music, painting, reading, model trains.
A whole other side to him. He remained Catholic too, right? Though sometimes critical.
Died a practicing Catholic, yeah.
Okay, let's shift to some of the shadows. Sinatra embraced that tough, working-class, Italian-American image, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. And he even admitted, pretty candidly, that without music, he probably would have ended up in crime. A racketeer, maybe?
And the alleged mafia ties were always there. Willie Moretti, his godfather, who supposedly helped with the Dorsey contract. Sam Giancana.
Persistent shadow. So ingrained it got fictionalized in The Godfather. Added to that mystique, that sense of danger.
The FBI certainly took it seriously. Over 2,400 pages in his file. Surveillance for decades.
Almost 5 decades. Documenting threats, extortion schemes, connections. But the key thing isn't just the connections, it's the impact they had.
Like losing his gambling license in 63, because Giancana showed up at Calaneva Lodge where Frank had a share.
Exactly. That pressure from the FBI and the Gaming Commission forced him to give up his shares in Calaneva and the Sands, despite his power.
Raises that question again. Did the connections help him early on, or ultimately hinder him? Create lifelong scrutiny, cost him opportunities, even damage the JFK relationship.
It's a complex calculation. The Havana Conference in 46 with Lucky Luciano led to those shame Sinatra headlines. He had a huge falling out with Giancana after Calneva.
His license was restored eventually, wasn't it, with Reagan support.
1981. But yeah, that shadow never fully disappeared.
His politics shifted dramatically, too, over his lifetime.
Full spectrum. Mm-hmm. Started as an ardent liberal, staunch Democrat. Campaign for FDR, Truman, Adlai Stevenson. Organized JFK's inaugural gala.
Big supporter. But then shifted later, became a major Reagan backer.
Big time. Donated $4 million to Reagan's 1980 campaign, reportedly. Reagan gave him the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 85.
What's fascinating, though, and maybe overlooked, is his lifelong commitment to civil rights, regardless of party.
Absolutely unwavering from a young age. Spoke out against racism, especially towards black people and Italians. Understood discrimination.
Played a big role in desegregating Vegas hotels and casinos. Refused to play segregated venues.
Major role, often behind the scenes. Held a benefit for Martin Luther King Jr. Junior King supposedly wept when Sinatra sang Old Man River, led the Rat Pack in boycotting discriminatory places, used his star power.
And his support for Jewish causes, too.
Lifelong sympathizer. Performed in Israel, donated his fee from Cast a Giant Shadow to a youth center there, raised millions in bond pledges for Israel later.
So the later shift to the Republicans, maybe more pragmatic
Right.
about influence.
Seems likely. Hayek's a complex guy who valued personal connections, loyalty, maybe more than strict ideology. He used his platform for causes he believed in.
Interesting about the JFK snub in 62, though, Kennedy stayed with Bing Crosby instead because of FBI concerns about Sinatra's mob ties.
Reportedly devastated Sinatra. Sobbed for 3 days after JFK was assassinated. Shows the depth of those connections and their consequences.
His final decades weren't exactly quiet either. Another comeback after that brief retirement.
Oh, yeah. Old Blue Eyes is back in 73. Album, TV special, massive comeback tour. Reestablished his dominance.
Though he caused that uproar in Australia, didn't he? Calling journalists, well, some colorful names.
Bums, parasites, fags, broads, and buck and a half hookers. Yeah, that fiery temper never fully left him.
He kept recording too. Trilogy, Past, Present, Future in 80.
Which gave us another anthem, Theme from New York, New York.
And those hugely successful duets albums in the 90s, remaking classics with contemporary stars.
Liza, Barbara, Bono, bridging generations, bringing his music to new ears. His last live public performance was in 95.
Fittingly singing New York, New York at his 80th birthday tribute, a poignant farewell.
By then, yeah, his voice had coarsened a bit. Lost some power, flexibility compared to his prime. But as Kitty Kelley said, that immutable magic, that sheer charisma.
Still captivated everyone.
Worldwide, he got all the honors. Kennedy Center Medal of Freedom, Congressional Gold Medal, 11 Grammys over his career.
And when he died in 98, age 82, after a heart attack, the tributes were huge.
Empire State Building turned blue. Vegas casinos dimmed their lights, stopped spinning for a minute. A grand gesture for the man who helped build the town.
His grave marker changed too. From the best is yet to come to sleep warm, Papa.
More intimate, yeah. His legacy isn't just the music, the films. It's that audacious spirit, that resilience, that reinvention. Sanpietro argued he exemplified the common man who reached the top of the heap, yet never forgot his roots.
Frank Jr. spoke at his funeral. There's the plaque in Hoboken, the park, the statue, schools named after him.
Frank Sinatra School of the Arts, the center at Hebrew University. His legacy extends far beyond the stage.
So, from those humble, scarred beginnings in Hoboken, literally brought back from the brink.
To the chairman of the board, commanding global stages, owning his own label.
Frank Sinatra's life was just an astonishing testament to raw ambition, incredible resilience, and that undeniable singular talent.
We've really seen how his challenging personal life, the relationships, the reputation struggles, the private battles, and his huge triumphs.
Were totally woven into the fabric of his art, created an entertainer like no other.
He truly embodied that complex American dream, dazzling, sometimes dark, always compelling, a force of nature who shaped a whole century of culture.
Sanpietro's point about him exemplifying the common man reaching the top but remembering his roots, that really hits home, doesn't it? Explains his enduring appeal.
Definitely. Master of recording, vocal genius, cultural icon. His power went way beyond the stage, shaped cool, shaped charisma for generations.
And the influence lives on. Tributes, portrayals, his music is still everywhere. One of the most significant figures of the 20th century, no question.
His rare gift was that connection, making every listener feel like he was singing just to them, sharing a secret, a heartache. That magic still resonates today.
Decades after his final bow.
Yeah.
So here's something to mull over, deep divers, as we wrap this up. Sinatra himself said, quite frankly, that without music, he might have ended up in crime.
Yeah, he was very open about that possibility.
Considering that intense drive, the volatile temper, the fierce loyalty, the sheer audacity, what do you think would have been his alternate destiny if he hadn't found his voice?
It's a fascinating what if. That energy had to go somewhere.
Makes you wonder how crucial finding the right channel is, you know, to turn that immense talent, that huge personality, into something legendary instead of something else entirely.
Something destructive, maybe. Yeah. Definitely food for thought.
Keep that in mind, deep divers. Until next time.